Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. And yes, indeed, we are broadcasting live this evening in the studio of PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network. We are live tonight, and we will not be on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio at 9 p.m. this evening. Our website is www.pcradioshow.org. And before we begin, what we want to do is some sad news is that we have a colleague that we worked with many years ago in the beginning. His name was Ross Greenberg. Joe?
Well, Hank, Ross was our first engineer when we stood on the WBAI studios.
Yes, and we also have another colleague on the phone that you want to talk to.
Well, when Russ was our first engineer when the studios of BAI were up on 8th Avenue, and with us was Russ as engineer. Hank, you and I were on the air, but also was a fellow, he used to call himself the round person on the air, Dave Burstein, and I think Dave is joining us tonight. Are you there, Dave?
I'm still pretty round.
I saw
all these years.
Actually, that's not true, Dave.
What, in 82?
I saw you a couple of weeks ago, and you really thinned out.
Well, good drugs.
Good drugs.
Well, Dave, whether...
No, that's actually true. Several of the standard diabetes drugs now work fairly well to take off weight.
I got to say, Dave, you sent me a new phone number for yourself, and when I put it into the address book, your new picture automatically appeared, and it was a round picture.
I haven't taken new pictures, but there's certainly a whole lot of me. That hasn't changed.
Well,
that's hard to change.
I do want to say that I was very, very shocked when I was browsing through Facebook last week and I saw an obituary that his sister had written. It was a very moving obituary. And it made me think that Ross died... He was 60 years old, and I remember while we were on the air helping to prepare his surprise 30th birthday party. Do you have some
remembrances? That happens to all of us. Don't complain.
Well, I can only complain if it doesn't happen, because 30 is an awful young time to go. Ross was around a long time after that birthday party. Dave, I think you can explain more about his software, but after he had been fairly successful with a program called FluShot, he bought a farm upstate New York, which he named Virus Acres, and I thought that was rather appropriate.
Well, it was called FluShot because it was one of the very first antivirus programs on the web, and it was a very different time. Somebody... A very bright programmer who really got into it was able to write a package that a few years later was one of the two or three best reviewed antivirus software packages in the world. A very different time than most of the time in the middle. We have some friends. Joe, Hank, how many people wrote VisiCalc?
Oh, one person.
Yep.
Dan Bricklin.
Yep. He had a partner who's the friend now, Franklin, Bob Franklin, but Bob basically handled the business side, and Dan programmed one of the three or four most influential small computer programs in history. Everything you do now on a spreadsheet traces back to these two guys at MIT who invented this first spreadsheet. It was called VisiCalc. And back then, things were a lot simpler. We're talking now 70s and the early 80s. It was starting, however, to become impossible for a single programmer to break through like that. For example, database programs. I don't know the answer, but I would guess that the most popular database program there in that era, which was DBase, had a team of a dozen programmers working on it. Lotus 1-2-3, which eventually took over from VisiCalc, probably had a team of a dozen. And almost all the software we used came from a big team. Does that correspond to the way you remember it, Joe and Hank?
It still is that way, because if you think back, what is, big apps and what is really succeeding are really the thoughts of a handful of people. When you have a big committee of people working on it, what you do is you get a compromise, and the least common denominator is not the best solution.
And it could well be, but it's impractical in most veins of software. You can't compete with Microsoft Word if you're a single programmer. Whereas once somebody wrote, what was the first shareware? It was PC something that was a word processor?
Well, actually, in terms of shareware, there was a lot of shareware.
But the first word processor that was
the first word processor that was shareware? I don't think that there was really any word processor that was shareware, but it wound up being, like WordStar, wound up being one of the most popular pirated piece of software.
PC Writer.
PC Writer was not shareware.
I always thought it was. The thing that was unique here was Dave was one of the things that we have to understand was that Ross took a look into something that was really not a major situation. As a matter of fact, one time on the air, we had a long discussion of whether viruses would really be important. At that time, there was, I forget the name of the two twins from India who were writing them. And for most of the people writing this kind of malware, it was identifiable who it was coming from. John McAfee, was also on the West Coast. He was looking into it, and he developed a antivirus. And so it was these two young men, Ross Greenberg and John McAfee, who had come out with anti-malware software. The thing that was going around, and I don't know how true it really was that Dave used to, Ross used to complain that McAfee would write some malware packages and release them at the same time he said his program could handle them. Ross never did that himself. He developed it and then went on to develop a couple of other programs. Unfortunately, at about that time in his life, he came down with some strange symptoms that made him feel very bad, and he went to see a doctor who told him he had the very early stages of muscular dystrophy. The last time I saw Ross was in my office about, 15, 20 years ago.
And was it muscular dystrophy or multiple sclerosis? I may have had it wrong.
Sorry. You're absolutely right. I always confuse those two. You're absolutely right. And he was staggering a little bit. And then he would sit down and he would be fine. And I asked him, had he been drinking, because Russ is not a drinker. But this was something you might see in somebody who was a little bit high but not drunk. And that's when he told me the very sad story of his illness. Shortly after that, he moved down to Georgia to become part of an experimental project to try and find a cure for muscular dystrophy.
Sclerosis. Not dystrophy, sclerosis, muscular sclerosis.
Oh, I'm sorry, I keep saying that.
There's no Jerry Lewis in this one.
The multiple sclerosis. And as he was down there, he got, as the conditions of the disease progressed, he got into more and more difficulty, and finally he had to actually leave home, and he was moved into a critical care nursing home. And that was where he finally passed.
And all this time, we're talking 20 years, until very recently, he was very visible on the web. I don't know whether he was doing it with an eye switch in the later years. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised. And that's one of the great things about the web. It really does give away for people who can't communicate any other way. So he was in the middle of various flames and arguments that I saw in passing. And what he said was not necessarily remarkable, but the fact that he still could, and it also is good news for how medicine is progressing, he did have 20 years still rational after being diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
Yeah, but physically he kept deteriorating. When he first told me that he was having trouble typing, I got him the Dragonware, and they were very gracious to donate their packages to him from time to time. But then it got to the point where his speech was so impaired that Dragonware couldn't interpret it. And there was a fellow down there in Georgia. I'm sorry, but I can't place his name. But he was in the obituary. He was referred to as Ross's angel of mercy, because he would come over with technology and develop it, install it, help him with it. All this time he was sick, he stayed in touch with the Internet Press Association and other groups that he was very deeply involved with. All I can say is I've known Ross since 3 weeks after I got my first computer, a K-Pro. He taught me how to read the BIOS on it. He taught me most of what I know of computing, except for all the stuff that Hank has taught me. And he will be sorely missed by all of his friends and colleagues.
And their sadness is a lesson that things have gotten better, and a reminder, because what I do now is keep track of networks, the Internet, telecom network, and so on, and that takes me to policy. You don't notice it, but buried in all the policy and the FCC requirements and some of the in the Internet standards and the web standards is ways to make it possible for somebody who cannot talk well enough to be understood, much less use his fingers to type, to still stay in touch. It's actually required in any software you do for the United States government to have some accessibility built in. And in the web standards, loads and loads of books and explanation on the web for how to write your software in such a way that it does what you want it to, even if the person is disabled. Because the number of disabled people in the world is much higher than you would think when you walk down the street.
You're absolutely.
So few of them get out there.
You're absolutely right, David. And Ross, in many ways, contributed to that. It's a very sad time for us all. But I thank you for joining me for talking and having some reminiscences of a very, very fine young man who was no longer young. Hank?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to get going.
Okay. You know, the major story that came out, or actually a news item, had to do with Yahoo. And last September, Yahoo admitted that 500 million users, their account probably been hacked by, you know, hacked into, and passwords were stolen and so on. And then later in the year, in December, it admitted that in a separate breach in 2013, 1 billion users might have been exposed to another hack. And now a new one that came out is that hackers has used forged cookies to access user accounts without a password between 2015 and 2016. And Joe, I have a big question to ask you. Have you closed your Yahoo account yet?
You know, it's not that easy. The Yahoo, in the early days, did not want to lose any of their members because they kept making money on the size of their database. You can close a Yahoo account, but it's not a matter of going to a single page and clipping unsubscribe me.
Well, I'm implying you should close your Yahoo account. Do you agree with me on it?
I do agree with you. I have already attempted to close my account. I don't think it's closed. And even if it's closed, they still have all the data in the database.
Yeah, when you close your account, that doesn't mean your information is scrubbed from the site. It's not. It's kept forever.
And if they're selling your name and your information to an advertiser, he's not going to stop running his ads just because Yahoo told him
to. Well, let me ask you. You know, we recommend And this is, by the way, strictly a personal thing. You know, I don't represent anyone, and Joe doesn't represent him, but based on this history of these violations, you know, drop the account. But my question is this. If you don't trust Yahoo to even drop the information, and now that Verizon is taking them over, you trust Verizon?
The easy answer is I don't trust anybody, but that's not really a fair answer. I think that Verizon will make every effort under their rules and their leadership. If you go to the Verizon site, you can read fairly easily their privacy policy, some of which you might disagree with, but that is their policy, and if you disagree with it, you don't have to do business with them. Yahoo, on the other hand, didn't care. They really didn't care. They didn't take the most careful chances that they should have.
Well, as you know, Verizon will be closing the, when I say closing, I meant that they're going to close a deal with Yahoo. They're still worth over $4 billion with all this all this information being hacked. They're still worth money. I can't believe it.
Well, they originally were going to pay $4.5 billion for Yahoo. The sale just went through, and they took a $350 million credit for the troubles. But, and there's a big but, anything that comes out of non-SEC-related lawsuits – they're laying off onto the original Yahoo people.
By the way, another big item, a big news item that came out was virtual reality with Best Buy. Joe, what is virtual reality?
That's unfortunately what I'm living through these days.
No, I'm not talking about your augmented reality. I'm talking about your virtual reality.
It's a technology that I don't know how many are old enough to remember the 3D stereoscopic pictures that we had ever since the early parts of the 20th century. Well, they took that concept of having two cameras at a different angle, the lenses in a different focus, and they took that concept and they moved it somehow into the digital world, and you can put on goggles or mask or whatever you want to call this strange-looking apparatus that straps over your eyes, and you can have a virtual experience in there. By that I mean you're not actually getting splashed with water from the Niagara Falls, but you feel like you are because you're right there at the Niagara Falls.
But that was a static picture that you saw. I was at a press conference where a company named Oculus, they had these, looked like a big set of binoculars that hang off the front of your face. And as you look, you see a change in the perspective. In other words, what you saw was a one static picture, but this one is, you can look around, you can see a 3D change no matter where you look.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to mislead you, Hank. When I was watching the video, if you will, of the Niagara Falls, as I turned my head, I saw different parts of the falls, and I actually felt as if any moment I was going to get wet. The splashes came all around me. I turned around. It was a 360-degree, I don't know what to phrase it, a virtual view. Reality.
Well, what it is that it's sort of like everyone is talking about it. It's a big deal. Virtual reality. Oculus, I believe, was recently purchased by Facebook. And they paid a pretty penny for it. And I know that with Microsoft and Best Buy and a number of others, they think that the gamers are going to be pushing that product because with games...
I did see one game that way, and it was absolutely amazing. I was part of the battlefield.
Right. I
didn't want to be. I had left it.
It really is pretty neat because what I saw was a football game, and you felt like, hey, I'm waiting to be hit, okay, you know, when they're coming at you. But what I was surprised by was that Best Buy, they partner with Oculus to give demos in all the Best Buy stores. Now they're going to close down half of those demos.
Well, I saw my sole experience with virtual reality was at the Best Buy store on, I think it was 44th Street and 5th Avenue, or 43rd Street and 5th Avenue, I'm not sure, right on the corner. And I was at one of these Oculus demonstration booths.
Well,
it was absolutely amazing. I can't believe they weren't selling.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not selling. I think there's two reasons for it. Is that, I think there's three reasons for it. One is that it's not cheap. That's number one. Number two is the content is in games, but it's got to be more than just games. And the third is most people don't even know what virtual reality is.
It's a very hard concept to explain. It's very easy when you see it. Think of this. Remember Technicolor movies first came out in the 1920s, 1930s?
No. The first one was, believe it or not, was with Judy Garland, The Wizard of Oz. Was the first
and
one in color.
How did you explain to somebody?
That was in the late 1930s.
And how did you explain to somebody who had never seen this what Technicolor was?
Can I tell you what I would like to say? Joe, you're a lot older than me.
Well, I did see.
No, I actually, I was impressed. Can I tell you what? I was impressed, but it didn't have that much of an impact on me for one reason. As a kid, I was watching cartoons. And when you watch cartoons in color, it's sort of like a cartoon and a real figure. It's sort of like it didn't matter.
Oh, well, you don't have much. I don't like you, Hank.
Hey, Joe, about 2, 3, 4 years ago, maybe about that time, we always get into this bit about the next big thing, the next big hit, the next big item you should invest in. And I know that some people invested very heavily into 3D printing. And
I know that one of your friends did.
Yeah, and what has happened with 3D printing is that the consumer level is still plastic stuff, it's still chess pieces.
No, there's a very inexpensive 3D printer that's metallic. Came out about 6 months ago.
Yeah, but you know what? It's not moving at all. And one of the companies that really pushed hard on it was MakerBot. And MakerBot were giving courses on it. I remember my two granddaughters attending a MakerBot seminar. They were impressed with little tiny chess pieces they brought back. They had these demos in the stores. But guess what? They're now in their fourth layoff in the last 2 years.
Well, you know, the product itself was aimed at, in many ways, children or younger people. But the prices were very serious elder people. I mean, you're talking hundreds and hundreds of dollars, and it's not cheap to run once you have it. It was probably in the early stages of the automobile or the horseless carriage, they had the same problem. It was a wealthy man's product, but wealthy men didn't want the horseless carriage. They still wanted a chauffeur or the bridal man.
Well, 3D printing will become viable when three things happen. Number one is that the time it takes to create an object is reduced by a magnitude. In other words, it can't be in hours and minutes. It's got to be a lot less faster. The other thing is that it's got to be a bigger. In other words, the device, the item itself, has to be able to produce a bigger item. The chess pieces are just too small.
Well, I don't even understand why they're doing it with chess pieces. I saw a machine how they were supposed to do it.
How they're supposed. And you know what the third is?
Star Trek has them on every scene. You know, it's a replicator, and that's what will sell.
Well, the third thing that actually will also is that you have to get past plastic. In other words, if you can do some metal. Now, it's real because it's being used to generate skin. Food and so on, but those devices are in the $100,000 range.
But NASA is very interested in them.
Oh, yeah, especially in space travel. By the way, Joe, you know, we have three segments that we have been working on, as you know, and people have been listening to us. We've been featuring now three feature segments, as I call them. One is by Dr. Alfred Poor on wearable technology. Another one that we just added is Joe Rzeszewski on.
Joe Rzeszewski is doing
on
what he's
tips.
Doing is easy computer tips for busy people.
And the last one is Marty Winston on home automation, and that's quite fascinating, at least, you know, if you're talking about big items and things. You know, people say, all you talk about is computers. Can you tell us a little more about it? So what we have done is that we've been moving in that direction, and what we'd like to do is get to those three segments now. So without further ado, well, let's cut over to the three feature segments.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider.
Can your voice tell you if you're getting sick? Funny question, but let me tell you, my wife always seems to know when I'm coming down with a cold days before I even realize it. So maybe there's something to that. With technology, we're used to having computers convert our speech into text to understand our spoken words as commands for quite some time. Now it's getting quite commonplace with Amazon Echo and Siri and other things like that. And there have been some companies that have been using a speech analysis to detect the emotion of a person. One of these companies is a company called Beyond Verbal, and they're based in Israel. And I had a chance to meet with them at CES. Basically, they have algorithms that can analyze a sample of speech and determine information about the person's emotions while they were speaking. They've actually got an app out that does this, but their algorithms are far more sophisticated. Their algorithms can actually identify up to 11 different moods, ranging from arousal to anger, which is all pretty cool. But what if you could find out more information from a short speech sample? Well, they did a research project along with Mayo Clinic. They studied cardiac patients. They took sound samples from cardiac patients. And note that speech samples, they're not recognizing the words. They're just listening to the tone, the inflection, the different sound characteristics of the speech itself. In this research with Mayo Clinic, they actually found a biomarker that correlates closely to coronary artery disease. So just by listening to somebody on the telephone, a doctor might be able to diagnose heart disease like that. They've gone beyond that, though, that in other studies, they've identified biomarkers for Parkinson's disease, for autistic spectrum disorder, and even for ADHD, which is all pretty remarkable. They're going to be licensing their technology to other companies to incorporate in devices and in their software. So this is going to be a real boon to telehealth, in my opinion, because it's going to be able to give doctors one more tool that doctors can use for remote monitoring and diagnosis of patients. A product that we've covered in this past is a thing called Spire, S-P-I-R-E. And basically, it's a wearable device that tracks your breathing. It tracks how often you breathe and the quality of your breath. And basically, it's a device that's designed to give you feedback to help you relax. The company conducted a research study with the help of Stanford and LinkedIn. The subjects in the study were LinkedIn employees. The experimental group received one of these Spire wearable devices, and the other control group did not. There were more than 100 employees in each group. One of the things they found, the group that wore the Spire device was able to reduce their stress by 10 to 12%. And this is based on the results of three different assessment tools that they had to measure stress levels. This is pretty remarkable. It's a good demonstration that these devices can actually produce a positive and measurable effect. Spire is looking to do more research along these lines and, in fact, is actively seeking research partners. If your organization is interested in working with them, you can find a link to their request for participants on the story at healthtechinsider.com. One of the devices that have become very popular with new parents is baby monitors. Now, in the beginning, they were simple intercom devices so that you could listen in to hear if the baby was crying. And then they added cameras and motion detection and all kinds of things. And the latest rounds are adding biometric measurements. They're keeping track of the baby's heart rate, breathing rate, temperature, and so forth. And this all sounds like a great idea. It would give parents, new parents, peace of mind knowing what's going on with their baby, which seems reasonable. But on second look, it may not be such a great idea. The Journal of the American Medical Association recently published a paper by two pediatricians and another expert in which they raised questions, they raised doubts about these devices and their usefulness. One of the important points to start right off with is there's no clinical proof that any of these devices have a benefit. As far as I know, there haven't been any studies that show that they save lives or have some other positive outcome. And in fact, it could be that the outcomes are negative. For example, one of the things a lot of these devices discuss in their marketing materials is sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS. And it's a terrifying thing. I remember when I was a new parent of a newborn, it was something we were very concerned about. Very often it's in the context of this device can't promise that it can prevent SIDS. However, it gives you a way to monitor your baby's health. This just needlessly puts fears into parents' heads and makes them think that maybe this device can help prevent it, even though they're not promising that they can. Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics actually has a policy statement on this. They tell their members, do not use home cardiorespiratory monitors as a strategy to reduce the risk of SIDS. This kind of biometric tracking isn't a positive deterrent for SIDS. Furthermore, this article points out, parents lack training to understand what it is this data means. They get these alarms and they don't know whether they're significant or not. And as a result, many of these infants are taken to the hospital, to the emergency room, to be checked out. And since they're brought into the system, doctors have to do due diligence and check them out carefully, which often means putting the child through unnecessary and often expensive tests that just aren't needed. Puts more stress on the child, puts more stress on the parents, and again, wastes a lot of money. The final point they make is many of these devices just aren't all that accurate in the first place. So the information that they're driven by isn't all that good to start with. The upshot of all this is my advice is consult your pediatrician before you buy any of these kinds of devices. If you've got one that looks or listens, that's fine. But if you want to get a device that goes beyond that, consult your pediatrician. Find out whether they think it's providing you worthwhile information and information that you can use.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Public service announcements. Brookdale Computer Users Group will be having a meeting on Thursday, February the 23rd at 6:45 p.m., and the topic of presentation is how to purchase and maintain the correct printing equipment. It will be held at the Middletown Library in Middletown, New Jersey. The Princeton PC Users Group next meeting will be held on Tuesday, February the 28th at 7 p.m., and their presentation is Partitioning a Hard Drive on Your Windows Computer, and it will be held at Mercer County Library, located in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will meet on Thursday, March the 2nd at 7 p.m. Presentation is Memory Development, and it will be held at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, located at White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on Polyglot Build 2s, Friday, March the 3rd, 8 p.m., and it will be held at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on photobooks, the compact way of storing memories, Tuesday, March the 7th, at the Community Room at the Computer Learning Center, located at 999 Lower Ferry Road, and their phone number is 609-883-1776. The New York Amateur Computer Club will be having their meeting on Thursday, March the 9th, 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building in New York, and photo IDs required. And finally, TCF 2017, formerly known as the Trenton Computer Festival, will be held on Saturday, March the 18th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and the theme of the festival will be Autonomous Vehicles. There'll be talks, workshops, vendors, and there'll be a banquet afterwards at the College of New Jersey. For more information, tcf-nj.org. And I hope to be there, and I hope to see you.
Hey, it's time for Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Busy people like you. I'm Joe Rejewski, author of the soon-to-be-released Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Ready for one of my favorite tips? It's an amazing feature of Microsoft Office and G Suite you can use every day, and for some reason, few people know about it, even though they've probably looked at it many, many times. Here's a simple, cool computer tip you need to know. This week I'm sharing with you one of my favorite tips. And the way I discovered this tip is probably more important than the tip itself, although I think the tip is pretty cool. For years, I noticed a little paintbrush icon in Microsoft Word, but I never bothered to investigate what it does. Maybe you've seen the same icon in Outlook, Word, Excel, or PowerPoint. Actually, if you use Google Apps, now called G Suite, it has a similar icon. When we stare at these icons and don't take the time to Google what they do, we are missing an opportunity to discover something that could save us a lot of time. I get it. I understand. You're busy. I'm busy. We're all busy. But does it really take that much time out of your day to throw into Google something like, what does Format Painter do? I mean, if you think about it, the more tips you know, the less you work. All right, so what is Format Painter? When you copy text into an email or a document or even a spreadsheet, often the font doesn't match, right? Maybe it's too big or too small or a different color or all of those. So what does everybody do? They mess with adjusting the font until it looks right. You know, change the font from Times New Roman to Arial, change it from 10-point to 12-point, remove the bold, whatever. Too much work. With Format Painter, you can be done in a second. Format Painter copies the exact look, the format of text you like to the text you need to change. The style of the font, the size of the font, and the color are all instantaneously copied to the text that doesn't look right. Format Painter is near cut, copy, and paste at the top of Microsoft Office products like Outlook, Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. If you use any of the G Suite apps like Docs, Sheets, or Slides, you'll notice a paint roller icon in the upper left corner of the toolbar near the icons for print, undo, and redo. Instead of calling it Format Painter, Google calls it Paint Format, but essentially does the same thing. To use Format Painter or Paint Format, just place your cursor in the text that you like, click either Format Painter or Paint Format, and then select the text you would like to change. To quote Gomer Pyle, Shazam, Shazam, Shazam. Instantaneously, your text will now look fantabulous. One additional feature you'll like is that if you double-click Format Painter or Paint Format, they'll remain active, so you can change the look of other sections of text. When you're done giving all your text a beauty makeover, just click Format Painter or Paint Format again to deactivate it. Try this tip now, and you'll never forget it. And the next time you see something you don't recognize on the toolbar or menu of an application, just Google it. You never know. You might be Googling something that will soon be saving you a lot of time. And that's this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Did you enjoy this tip? You can check out more great tips for non-techies in my new book. Just visit www.simplecomputertipsforbusypeople.com. I'm Joe Rujewski. Over and out.
Thank you, Joe. And now we have Home Automation by Marty Winston.
What's lighting your house? In my house, it's all LED bulbs, and LED bulbs are actually what got me thinking about building a house that's 40 years maintenance-free. I invite you to take a look at 40yearhouse.com to see everything else we're doing on that theme and its related themes. But the thing about LED bulbs that got me fascinated with them early on was that they would last 25,000 hours, 23 years at 3 hours a night, which is the way the federal standards are written. They proscribe 3 hours a night. 25,000 hours of light without having to change a bulb. Among other things, that means don't buy spares. They'll be in the closet a long time. But LED bulbs were just the starting point. There are three phases in the progression of LED bulbs. We are in the second phase. In the first phase, and I shouldn't have said bulbs, in the first phase of LED lighting, you have bulbs that replace old bulbs. Just like when light bulbs first came out, the incandescent light bulb first came out, they were largely replacing gas fixtures or lanterns and built in the same shapes. So with LED bulbs, you don't change the fixture. You just take out the old bulb, you screw in the LED bulb, and don't have to screw another one in for a very long time. That's fine. And then I learned about LED fixtures, in which the bulb is not part of it anymore. The lighting is built directly into the housing. The lighting and the housing are one unit, and it can be pretty much permanently attached to a wall or a ceiling or wherever you need it. What you see in an LED fixture is a longer life expectancy on the order of 60,000 to 100,000 hours. On that same federal standard, that's well over 40 years, even if you go beyond 3 hours a night. Now, A light that lasts that long is very attractive. But the light lasting that long starts you thinking about what is there in that light. By the way, the third phase, which I didn't mention, which we're not at yet, is integrated lighting, where the wall or the ceiling is the light. Won't even begin to tell you how that's going to happen. We've seen experiments. Don't really like any of what we've seen yet, but somebody will figure it out. With an LED fixture, as in fact, if you could look inside with the LED light bulb, you're dealing with the emitter itself, the light-emitting diode itself. If I use the term emitter, you can think light-emitting diode. The light-emitting diode, the emitter itself, has to work at a voltage other than 120 volts or whatever your wall's putting out, or 12 volts in a car, because it's a diode. It's not really designed for that voltage. So part of what's in there is a power supply built to convert where whatever it's getting, usually 110 volts, into whatever that emitter wants to see. In a light bulb, you're not seeing it, so it's really just called a power supply, or the formal term that's used for the power supply in a fixture is a driver. Oh, driver. Yes, it's a driver. The driver takes line voltage, converts it into, generally these days, 12 volts or 24 volts DC, and feeds into the array of LED emitters that's part of the fixture. Those might be, for example, flexible or rigid ribbons of LED emitters, and those are a very neat way to create a light. How about dimming? How does dimming happen? Well, dimming happens with an extra input into the driver, and that input is going to be addressed by something that's called a controller. It might be as simple as a slider on the wall, but it's more likely going to be its own intelligent electronics. And in building systems, controllers are networked one way or another to be part of what happens. What I'm using in the house is from Synapse Wireless. It allows those controllers to connect wirelessly to a central hub, so I can say, hey, light over there and light over there go dim, light over there go bright, light over there turn on, light over there turn off. It's a controller. You talk to it, and it makes it part of however you've decided to automate. It could be something local, like a presence detector, the passive infrared. Oh, I see a horned buddy. It's moving. I'll turn the light on. Or it could be something as simple as a light and dark detector. Room is dark. Turn on light. Or a timer, something else. The more you have intelligence at the feeder end of the controller, the more intelligent the operation can be. Now, I want you to consider the LED fixture. As I said, it is the housing and the light source melded into one. And, of course, the things that came out first echoed the things that we were familiar with. They might look like a bank of fluorescent tubes. It might look like a can in the ceiling pointing down. It might look like a chandelier, or it might look like a lamp on a post from the floor or a table. And personally, I have come to really not like having my visual field intruded upon by the stalagmites and stalactites of traditional lighting. I don't want poles dropping down. I don't want poles thrusting up. I just want light. How does the sky do it? Have you looked at the sky? The sky does it by diffusing light. You might see the sun. You don't want to look at it very long, but the light source can be hidden in an interior space, can be out of direct view of your eyeball, so you're never actually looking at the emitter, and it can take advantage of walls and ceilings as diffusers, as ways of taking the source of light and making it effectively illuminate the interior space. Now, when they build light-emitting diodes, and I've been to some of these laboratories, they spend a lot of time on the secret recipes of phosphors. Phosphors are the things in there that glow, where the light comes from. The rest is excitation. If you want to direct drive an LED, it's going to be red or green. It's going to be yellow, maybe, if it's got red. I mean, they're the primary colors is most of what you're dealing with. there are some other emitters, but what they've done in order to make the white LED happen, and white is an amalgam, or amalgam if you're a dentist, it's a combination of all different flavors of white. How do you get one flavor of white? And by flavor of white, I'm referring to something that's technically called color temperature. Old-time television, color temperature in the studio was, also movies, 3,200 degrees Kelvin. That was considered warm white. These days, warm white is anywhere from 2,200 to 3,200, sometimes 3,500. And as you get down into the lower numbers, you're getting more amber. You're getting a little pinkish sometimes. It's not really a white light anymore. Sunlight is generally over 6,000 degrees Kelvin. Outdoor tubes or emitters or other lighting tends to be in the 5,000 to 6,000 degree Kelvin and up range. But people, and I've learned this from a lighting architect, people are uncomfortable with how much blue is in daylight color temperatures. 5,000 to 6,000 degrees Kelvin makes some people edgy. So the compromise that is often used in living spaces, especially where food is prepared, where food is selected, where makeup is applied, where clothing is chosen. In those things, it's important to see the true colors. And to see true colors, you need to be closer to daylight. What they choose is 4,100 degrees Kelvin. So for my purposes, I consider warm to be 3,000 to 3,200. I consider cool or near daylight, fake daylight, if you like, to be around 4,100 degrees Kelvin. Now, I mention that because those attributes are important. If it's going to be in the light bulb, it should be in the room. And the wrong wall or ceiling can spoil that. So let's look at the attention that goes into the secret recipe for the light. It's got to do with the color temperature. It also has to do with a variable which is cheated from time to time called the CRI for color rendering index. And that really speaks to how nicely blended the mix of whites happens to be. Now, luminosity, the amount of light that's being created, is important. The quality of light, the CRI, is important. The target color temperature is important. But you lose control over those factors as soon as the photons emerge. That's out of your hands. The ability to retain a color temperature without externally coloring it, like the ability to preserve brightness and the ability to distribute the light efficiently in a room without subjecting people to the discomfort of direct emitter reflections. You can't have a mirror on the wall. You're going to see that emitter and it's going to be uncomfortable again. All of those things all depend on the ceilings and walls, especially if you're taking light and mimicking the sky and washing your light down the wall across the ceiling. The most luscious white light diffused by a bright pink wall becomes a pinkish light. Any color on any illuminated wall or ceiling impacts the nature of light in that space. And that includes the flavors of white, the quality of white. A neutral gray will simply reduce lighting intensity. A warm white light hitting a blue flavoring white on the wall or ceiling will make the space a little more like outdoors and a little less like a comfort space. A daylight white light coming off a warm white wall and ceiling will net a warmer tone into the room. You hear it happening now, right? You get it? Coloration of this sort may be counterproductive. Lighting that's too warm, a white, or too tinted can lead to bad judgment in preparing food, back to that, selecting clothing, or applying makeup. You want to get that right, don't you? Light that's too cold can make occupants edgy or uncomfortable. And again, that's from lighting architects who have noted the phenomenon. The best solution is to coat ceilings and walls, or at least upper walls, with a paint selected as a whitest white or an LED light white. Its finish should be as glossless as possible. A flat or matte or eggshell can work. And light shining on its surface should diffuse into a surrounding glow, making it effective at communicating more of a fixture's light to adjacent spaces. Within that, a premium paint has an implied edge in longevity, suggesting less frequent need for maintenance or reapplication. Now, I got in touch with Benjamin Moore Paints, and they sent me, and I'm reading from the can, they sent me their Aura, which is their premium line, OC-152 Super White with an eggshell finish. I've tested it. It's a terrific choice. Now, you may find another white you like better. You might not like my choice. I like my choice because I test this stuff. But make your own. Well, that's all the light I can put on this subject this week. So, back to you.
Thank you, Marty. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay warm. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.